point in the middle of the night.
By whom?
By people that I assumed were military, but I now look back and I have to wonder if they were regular military or if they were government contract, more quasi-military people. I hate to think that our regular military would be doing that kind of thing. So I'm not sure if it was regular military or not, but I do know that I was taken out of the motel room at gunpoint. And we were impressed. It was to impress upon us that we were not to step out of line one little bit. I was taken out there in the middle of the night to the radar site. It was a surface air missile radar site. And they said, we're going to have you track some strange-looking aircraft. You're not to speak to anybody else on the crew beyond what's necessary to run the radar. We'll be watching you the whole time. And they gave us fatigues to wear with no rank insignia and no name tags on them, no identifying marks. And so we had to run the radar, see if we could track these things. And they could not be tracked.
Can you describe these things for us?
Well, as far as a radar return, they gave very, very poor radar return, and then they just would disappear off the scope. It's like they'd appear in one part of the sky and then suddenly effectively disappear and be someplace else. So there's no way that the radar could maintain an active lock on these things. And a surface-to-air missile or radar tracks craft with a little tiny, what they call a pencil beam. So it's not a big sweep-the-sky radar, it's a targeting radar. So the big sweep-the-sky radar tells us where to look in the sky to pick up a bogey, so to speak. And then we point our radar in that part of the sky, and we get a lock on it with this little tiny beam, which helps us target it for a surface-to-air missile. In theory, of course, we didn't have missiles out there because we were just a training site. So we would try to track. They couldn't be tracked. We completed the test, and then I remember standing out on the deck of the radar van, looking up in the sky at what we'd been trying to track, and they were saucers. They were they looked like extraterrestrial craft to me. Now they could have been real extraterrestrial craft that were captured or obtained some way. Or they may have been back-engineered craft, or they may have been a combination of both.
Okay, so they're circular in shape.
Yes.
How big were they?
Big. I would say anywhere from 30 to 50 feet diameter.
Mm-hmm.
My attention was on the closest one. It was... maybe 100 yards away, and it was glowing orange on the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
There's a sound coming from it that I describe every time because I really don't know how else to describe it. It was like a sound that comes out of speakers at a rock concert when the speakers are on but no music is coming through.
Yeah, just
kind of that low hum.
Uh-huh.
With a little, you know, crackle to it now and then.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked up in the sky, and I'm looking at these things, and any awe or wonder that I might have felt about it was pretty much eclipsed by just being terrified, because I only had a secret security clearance, and what I was seeing was classified way above top secret. I was sure of that.
Why would that terrify you?
Because anybody in your audience who understands the military and hierarchy and security classifications knows that if you see something that you feel is classified above your level, you feel like you shouldn't be seeing it.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of like when Carl Wolf in the Disclosure Project was shown those photos of bases on the moon, and he said he became really afraid, that he didn't want to look at it anymore. He felt his life might be in jeopardy from being shown something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I understand exactly what he was talking about, because that's how I felt that night, looking at those things in the sky.
Why would you fear that your life would be in jeopardy?
Well, I just didn't feel that a secret security clearance would clear me to see what I was seeing. And the fact that I didn't have a top secret clearance that would clear me to see this and maybe work with it, I just was really scared. And remember, I'd already been taken out there at gunpoint.
Yeah.
And forbidden to speak to anybody, and we were under very tight control. And guns were there, and guns were part of the experience trained on us.
Did, while you were working, did they have the guns trained on you then, or just when they took you out of the room?
They didn't really have them pointed at us while we were working. They did just have them, they had them available, let's just say that.
Okay, so what happens after you, you see these, how many saucers were there?
There were quite a few in the sky. It was hard to kind of keep track of them because they were moving around. I just kind of watched the one that was closest because I really wanted to see the detail in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pretty smooth. But I'm guessing there could have been anywhere from 9 to 12 to 15.
Okay. Okay, so after you have seen this and realize this is way above my classification,
mm-hmm.
And you're scared, what happens next?
Well, we were put on a bus, an old school bus type of thing that was painted dark blue.
Mm-hmm.
The windows were painted over, and we were driven someplace that I, again, assumed was Area 51. I can't verify that for absolute sure because the windows were painted over and I didn't see exactly where they took us.
Okay. I want you to hold it right there because we have a break that's just about to take over. And when we come back, let's remember we're on the bus and you're being taken to some place that you assume is Area 51. And we'll pick up right there. Niara, when we had to step away for break, you had finished this test. You'd been taken out to the test range at gunpoint with, I suppose, all the other crew, members of the crew had been taken at gunpoint as well. You were made to attempt to track on radar what turns out to be flying discs. And you see them visually after the test is over. They put you and the crew, the rest of the crew, on a bus, and they take you somewhere. And when you get off the bus, you assume that you're at Area 51. Do you have any idea how long a bus ride that was?
I'm guessing 30, 45 minutes.
Okay, so would that be about right, going from Tonopah Test Range over to Area 51? Would that be about the right travel time?
It's possible, yeah.
Okay, so you get there, and the bus comes to a stop. What happens?
Well, we get off. There is a hangar type of area, lots of lights on there. We're walked through that area, kind of passed out of it, and taken to a medical facility, something that I would call a dispensary. It's kind of a military term. It's not quite a hospital. You know, they do some medical procedures there, but it seemed dispensary-like to me rather than like a real hospital.
Okay.
We were put in a waiting room where the lights were off in the waiting room. The chairs were arranged in kind of a, what I thought was kind of an odd way. The waiting room chairs were catty-corner from, like, if the room was square, they kind of went across from catty-corner from one corner to another.
Mm-hmm.
And behind the chair, the row of chairs, where our backs were to, was a hallway with double doors and windows, and they had the lights on in that hallway, I guess to shine just a little bit of light into that room without the lights being on in the room itself.
Okay.
And so we sat in those chairs. I think that there was quite a few people there. I'm not really sure how many. Like I said, mostly I was just scared. And I can't, because I was so scared, I was mostly aware of being scared and not so aware of the accuracy of time passing. So mm-hmm. just to throw that in there.
Okay.
So I sat waiting in the chair, and mostly there were men there, okay? I might have been the only woman there. I'm not positive of that, but it's possible, because the radar field is pretty much a male-dominated field. So they called people into this one little side room. People would go in there, and they wouldn't come out the same way. Then it became my turn. They called me in there, and I was told to lay down, didn't have to take any fatigues off or anything. I was told to lay down on a stainless steel examining table. There was an armed security guard in the room, I'm assuming to keep an eye on me, make sure I didn't bolt and run, which I certainly felt like doing. But I laid down on the table, and it was like an old style stainless steel table.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like something maybe from the 40s or 50s, you know. So I laid there getting more and more scared, you know, getting more and more terrified, wondering what the heck is going to happen to me next. And finally, a guy comes in the room, the same door I entered, wearing a white lab coat, walks past the security guard at the foot, you know, standing near the foot of the table, up around to the right side of my head, and he said, "Stay calm," three times in a very deadpan, sort of monotone voice. And when he got up beside the right side of my head, he kind of brought his hand up in one smooth move and injected me in the side of the neck with the hypodermic. And it was kind of like he had it hidden in the sleeve of his lab coat or something, because I didn't see it when he came in.
Mm-hmm.
So he did the injection, and immediately it's like I felt this rush of chemical that went straight to the brain and went into shock, you know, from the just whatever it was. And I didn't look too much beyond that point with Bud Hopkins. But when I had the session with Gloria Hawker, it took me beyond that point. So I'll just kind of keep going.
Yeah.
What happened at that point was I just felt like my body was going into shock. Suddenly, that one security guard that was in the room and another one were on either side of me. They were pulling me up by my arms off the table and took me to this one door, a different door than the one I came in. And they opened that door, and there was a long flight of stairs going down, and it seemed like they just were one flight of stairs that went down, no switchbacks, like most mm-hmm. stairwells have.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Went way down this long, long, long staircase, and I'm being half drug, half carried. And at the bottom of the stairs, there was a little room that they tossed me in there, shut the door, locked it. It was an empty little cubicle, had one light bulb sticking out of the wall in an upper corner. And I noticed on one wall there was a mirror sort of glass. And, you know, I had just enough cognition left to realize that was probably an observation glass.
Mm-hmm.
Mirror on my side and glass on the other side. And I just went through the effects of the injection at that point. And what I experienced didn't really make sense to me, but I just keep telling it the way I experienced it. I don't remember feeling pain, but I do remember feeling like I was going to somehow come apart. And the way that I've described it more recently is it felt like somehow I was turning to fizz, like soda pop fizz.
Mm-hmm.
That I just felt tingly all over, but tingly isn't even the right term. It's like I was, like my body was having a reaction that felt like I was going to either dissolve or come apart or something was going to happen. And it was just, it was very frightening to feel like my body was like losing some kind of cohesion or something. So I laid on the floor of that room with my arms around my knees, kind of curled up in a ball, you know, trying to hold myself together. And it felt so strange. I remember screaming quite a bit until finally the effects started to subside, and I just lay there. I stopped screaming at that point, and I was just laying on the floor, kind of exhausted, but was starting to feel more or less normal again. And about that point when I was, you know, just beginning to recover, the two security guards came into the room, and I was drug out, and then I was sexually assaulted by both the security guards, while the people that had been in the other room watching, they also watched the assaults.
Have you given any thought to why there's a group of people watching this assault? Because obviously if they're watching, it was pre-planned. They knew it was going to happen.
Yeah.
Why are they observing this?
Well, my guess from all of the study I've done trying to understand what happened, it was to increase my level of discomfort and increase the level of trauma. Because trauma-based mind control is a process where you introduce extreme trauma into someone because you want to get them to bury the memory of what they've experienced. You know, put it away someplace, fracture it away and stick it in the subconscious where it's going to be out of your way and you won't remember it. It's actually a protection that your own psyche does for you. If something happens to you that's more than you can handle, then your subconscious breaks that piece of memory off and sticks it into the subconscious until such time that you can handle remembering it.
Let me ask you to speculate on something.
Mm-hmm.
Why would this group of people who were in charge of this and obviously observing this, why would they, the purpose is they don't want you to talk about this.
Mm-hmm.
So why would they opt for, let's try to make her not remember?
Mm-hmm.
Why would they opt for that as opposed to, let's just kill her?
Mm-hmm.
Because with this method, there is always the chance you might remember, and you have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, they could have done that. They certainly threatened to.
Mm-hmm.
In some of the other memories that I've had and some of the flashbacks that I've had.
Mm-hmm.
But let's think back to the Roswell crash. Now, I heard and studied a little bit that over 400 people were terminated or killed to keep the Roswell secrets.
Okay.
And so that's a lot of people to make go away.
Mm-hmm.
And questions get asked, and these people have family, and they're wondering, okay, what happened? And then there's all this stuff around the Roswell crash, and people are suspicious. So I think it gets to a point where you can't just make people go away without good explanation. I just don't think there's quite as much liberty to just kill people outright anymore that there may have been at one time. And
okay.
I think people have a lot of confidence in their trauma-based mind control techniques, and which is foolish because the human organism is extremely resilient and it has healing modalities built right into it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, eventually most people, I think, are going to recover at least some of it.
Mm-hmm.
And but I think too that these monsters,
mm-hmm,
rely on the idea that nobody's going to believe it.
Right. And that was the difficult part for me after I came out of hypnosis with Bud Hopkins. I told him, I said, little gray guys with big eyes, I was ready for. And there were some of those in when we look back in my childhood nightmares.
Mm-hmm.
Little gray guys with big eyes, I was prepared for, but I had never heard of anything like the MILAB experience up to that point. It was all new information to me. And for me, that was another validating factor, because, you know, with the gray abductions, you know, that's kind of been part of the popular culture for a while. You know, so if I remember gray alien abductions under hypnosis, you know, you could say that that was, I was suggestible, that I'd heard it other places and I kind of put it in there.
Mm-hmm.
But with the MILABs, I'd never heard of that. It was completely new to me. It was a completely new idea, concept, experience that I had never heard of before. And so it set me on a quest to try to find out what the heck is really going on here. Does this really go on? You know, can I believe my own experience that I had under hypnosis? And to my horror, I found a lot more supporting data and testimony out there than not.
We are talking this evening with Niara Eisley, a former U.S. Air Force member, and she's telling us an amazing and disturbing story of what happened to her while on active duty and stationed at Nellis Air Force Base. And, you know, you made a good point as we were approaching the break, and that is you were prepared for little gray guys with big eyes, but this whole experience was something that you were totally unaware of. You had never even thought that such a thing existed, and yet it happened to you. Let's move forward a bit, and because this is not your last experience with this, is it?
No. I believe those experiences happened periodically. I don't think they were the norm, but I do think that they happened from time to time during that 3-month period.
Mm-hmm. You were taken somewhere that was not Area 51. You were taken somewhere off planet, weren't you?
Yes.
When did that happen?
Well, it happened sometime during that 3-month period, and I'm guessing that it happened toward the end of it.
Tell us about that one.
There was one security guard. He had kind of blonde, wavy hair, real cold blue eyes. I've come to think of him as kind of a sociopathic individual, because he really enjoyed inflicting pain and suffering. He was the one that kind of took me to this one facility. It was kind of like a hangar, and a small one, kind of underground. But it had an open area that kind of went out. You know how Bob Lazar talked about garage doors in the side of mountains?
Mm-hmm.
Well, this was like seeing that from the inside.
Okay, now, you say he took you to this hangar. Were you out at the Tonopah Range working, and then he took you to this hangar, or did he come to your hotel room and take you at gunpoint? How did that happen?
Well, I think being taken out at gunpoint was pretty standard. It's just, again, to kind of just impress on you that you're being controlled.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the vehicles that were used were big, like Chevy or GMC Suburban vehicles or buses.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was taken out in this particular instance and taken to this hangar by this particular security guard. And he gave me clothes that I had to put on, and they seemed like these kind of shapeless sort of silvery garments. And so I had to, you know, strip down and change right there in front of everybody, and put on these silver things. And the silver clothes were unusual in that once they were on, they kind of vacuumed themselves onto your body and fit your body perfectly, mm-hmm. no matter what your shape was. So I'm guessing it was some kind of extraterrestrial material. And so it was silvery. And then I was told to get on the craft, and there was a ladder underneath it that I had to climb up and get into. And this blonde security guard kind of smirked at me and said, "See you when you get back, sweetheart." And I knew that that meant more abuse. So anyway, I climbed up aboard.
Okay, let's describe this craft first. Mm-hmm. It's in the hangar. What does it look like?
It's a saucer-shaped craft. Little different than the one that I first saw out on the deck of the radar van. Mm-hmm. Not quite like Bob Lazar's sport model, but close. You know, not quite so sleek as that one.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you climbed up this ladder into the craft, mm-hmm. Did it appear to be larger inside than it would appear to be outside?
Yes, it did.
I've heard that about them. Can you kind of talk to us about that a little bit? Kind of how large did it seem on the inside?
Boy, you know, it seemed like it could be twice as large on the inside as it looked on the outside. It was kind of strange. A little disorienting to be in there, mm-hmm. somehow. And I was told to lay down on the floor. And there were two other male personnel that were also laying there on the floor. And I felt like we were going to be shipped wherever we were taken, like cargo.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just lay on the floor and shut up and don't make any noise, and you're going to go someplace. And
could you see controls and screens and, you know, technology? Could you see that inside?
I couldn't see too much of that. It seemed more like a scout craft kind of thing, because I didn't really see other rooms. I just saw the inside. Mm-hmm. of the craft, and there were chairs around the center. So there was like a beam that kind of went all the way through the center of the craft at the very center of it. And around that beam, there were some chairs. And I assumed that, you know, some officers were going to come on board and occupy the chairs, since we were told to lay on the floor. And I didn't really see too much instrumentation. I just saw the chairs, but there did seem to be some kind of console around where the chairs were positioned.
Did officers come on board?
Yes. I believe two of them came on board.
And they occupied the chairs?
They occupied the chairs.
Okay.
And I'm not a big person that gets into a lot of reptilian information, mm-hmm. but there was a reptilian there that, for some reason, I'm assuming that he was a pilot, mm-hmm. that he was piloting the craft. And he was standing behind the beam, and he moved out into view from behind the beam just for like maybe a minute or less. And I saw this creature, and it kind of took my breath away just looking at it. And then it kind of moved out of sight again. And that was one brief glimpse that I had of a reptilian being.
Can you describe that reptilian for us? What did it look like?
Well, it was kind of, it's hard to say if it was green or brown. It was kind of something in between.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't see it very well. It was kind of dark in there. So I can't really be sure of the description of the color. The eyes were yellow, and
how tall was he?
Very tall, 8 feet or more.
Mm.
And he, it was kind of like the way I've described it in the past is it's like a rattlesnake.
Okay.
That morphed halfway into a man, into a shape with arms and legs, and the head or the face still had some of that kind of shape to it.
Now, did these officers talk with this being?
No, not that I could see or understand or hear.
Did you hear any sound or communication from that being?
No, I didn't. I actually wanted to just look away from it. I didn't even want to look at it. It was a scary thing to look at.
And was it also wearing this silvery suit?
No, it wasn't.
Was it wearing any type of uniform?
I don't recall that it was, actually, no.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And now you said that this reptilian was, you had the sense that this was the pilot.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Did you notice if he sat down or did he remain standing?
If I had to make a guess, I'd say that he remained standing. But I'm not positive about that. Like I said, it's kind of an animal thing. You know, you get scared of something like that. You don't want to look at it and mm-hmm. just look away hoping that it won't notice you.
Yeah.
That's kind of how I felt about it at that time.
Okay, we're going to step away for a break. When we come back, we have a good long time before we have to have another break. And we will get into where you went on this craft and what happened. Ladies and gentlemen, we are talking this evening with Niara Eisley, former U.S. Air Force personnel, and she's talking about things that happened to her while she was on active duty in the U.S. Air Force. Niara, you were telling us about this event that where you were taken at gunpoint and again, and you were taken out to this hangar. There was a disc-shaped craft in the hangar, and you were made to put on this silvery suit that kind of vacuum-packed itself to you after you put it on, and then climb up the ladder into the craft. You were told to lay on the floor. There were two males also in silvery suits already laying on the floor. And then a couple of officers come in and sit down in the chairs that are in there. And a reptilian about 8 feet tall comes in. And you said that you had the sense that that's the pilot, but you just didn't want to look at him and you turned away. And about there is where we took the break. So what happens next?
Well, as soon as all the people that were going to be on board were aboard, the couple officers that took chairs, the craft became active.
What do you mean by that?
Well, you kind of feel a vibration.
Okay.
I felt a vibration through the floor, and as it lifted off, you know, it moved out of the hangar in the vibration, and then when it lifted off, there was a sensation of G-forces, but nothing really heavy duty. I mean, it felt for a couple instants like my body was pressed into the floor a little, you know, felt heavy,
mm-hmm.
but not for very long, for 10 seconds or less.
Okay.
And then
How many people were on board?
How many people were on board?
Mm-hmm.
So three, me and the other two gentlemen laying on the floor, the pilot, and I'm guessing two officers, but it seemed like there were some other people on board, too, in areas that I couldn't really see. It was more sensing that they were there than actually seeing them.
Okay. Okay, so a slight G-force when you first took off, and then it kind of normalized, and you didn't
yeah.
sense that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then what happened?
Well, we were on there for, I'm guessing, 20 to 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of a distorted sensation, so can't be sure of the time. But I felt the craft land, and we were told to get up and disembark. And when I got off, it looked to me like I was on the moon, and I'm pretty sure that that's where I was on the moon.
Okay, now, when the craft landed, mm-hmm. Did it pull into or did it land inside an enclosure anywhere or just out on the surface?
It landed out on the surface,
mm-hmm.
And this is an odd part that seems like, you know, it should be like a vacuum out there. But when we got off the craft, there may have been a force field or something in place to keep some kind of atmosphere there.
Mm-hmm.
Because when we walked from the craft to the building, there didn't seem to be anything that would keep the vacuum out, but yet there was air to breathe. Either that or there's air on the moon, and they're just not telling us.
Well, you know, there have been clouds seen on the moon.
Yeah.
And if you have clouds, you have atmosphere.
Yeah.
What about the sensation of weight? Did you feel as if you were lighter, or did it feel pretty much like it does on Earth?
I felt a little bit lighter.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things, Niara, that we get told, the official story, is that gravity on the moon is 1/6 of what it is on Earth. However, I have had scientists here on this show who have explained, and I can't do the calculation, but they say it's 66%.
Hmm.
So gravity, according to them, is 66% of what it is here on Earth. Gravity on the moon.
Mm-hmm.
I've never been to the moon, and I'm not a physicist, so I certainly cannot vouch for either figure. But it's interesting that you felt a little bit lighter, mm-hmm. because if it was 1/6, you'd feel a lot lighter.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so you disembark, you're on the surface. Is it light or is it pretty dark out there?
Well, there are lights around the buildings. Otherwise, you know, it seemed kind of dark to me.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a lot of light just coming from the facilities. And it's... a lot of difficult things happened for me there, and it's still not easily recallable.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of things that I can tell you, some things like I was worked really hard doing some work with electronics where I was operating machinery.
Mm-hmm.
I was operating machinery for excavation. And then when that was done, they just had me do kind of hard labor type work, you know, lift and haul and carry and stack and push and stuff like that. And then there was more sexual assault that happened at night. It was kind of like being passed around for entertainment.
Okay. Now... And let me say, I just said okay, and I don't want to make it sound as if I'm not taking that seriously. I'm taking it very seriously, and I just don't think it's really necessary for us to get too involved with that, other than to know that it happened. I know it's a very difficult memory for you.
Yeah, it is.
So let's talk about the personnel that were already there.
Mm-hmm.
Were they wearing any type of uniforms?
Some of them seemed to just be wearing regular clothes.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them were in uniform. My sense is that more officers there in uniform that were visiting rather than regular personnel there. It's like they come up there and they check things out and they get a look around and then they go back to Earth. But the personnel up there, this is just a guess, because I would really have to have more hypnosis and be willing to open up and look at this more deeply.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm guessing that it's primarily government contractors, you know, contract type work up there rather than regular military.
Okay, now there were officers there. These would be U.S. Air Force officers?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Were they aware of what was happening to you?
Yes, some of them were.
This would be an extremely serious crime.
Mm-hmm.
And they were, whether they actually participated or whether they simply were aware, either way, it would be an extremely serious crime, what they did.
Yeah.
I would think these guys would be terrified now because of your continual regaining of more memory.
Mm-hmm. Well, they could be.
Have you been threatened or harassed since you went public? No?
I haven't, and my guess is because a lot of this comes from hypnosis.
Mm-hmm.
And they have an organization out there that the CIA put in place called the False Memory Syndrome Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And so they can, they have that organization to discredit people who remember things under hypnosis. And I've dedicated a significant portion of a chapter in my book to what I think about the False Memory Syndrome Foundation. And what I think about how hypnosis can be accurate. I'm not saying it's foolproof, and I think that it can be abused. But John Mack had things to say about hypnosis and its veracity and its use as a tool, because the information flows straight from the subconscious, and the conscious mind is kind of out of the way, and it doesn't edit the information. The information just flows out as it is remembered by the subconscious. And once upon a time, hypnosis, testimony from hypnosis was accepted in courts of law.
Well, I was going to say that.
Yeah.
I was going to point that out, that there was a time, not so long ago, when testimony of information obtained during hypnosis was admitted into evidence in courts of law.
Right.
It's interesting, though. The same thing is true of a polygraph test, and I've heard people who absolutely say, I'm an ex-cop, okay,
mm-hmm.
So I'm familiar with this. I've heard people who absolutely don't know what they're talking about, but are absolutely assured they do, say, well, polygraph tests are notoriously unreliable. That's not true.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A polygraph test is neither reliable or unreliable. It's the polygraph examiner that's either reliable or unreliable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's how the questions are framed, how they are asked, the wording of those questions. All of that's where you get the reliability or unreliability. And by the way, folks, in case you don't know, polygraph is not, you think polygraph is not admissible in court? It is. Polygraph is admissible in court under certain circumstances. And I just wonder, I don't know with hypnosis if it has gotten back to that status yet, that it would be admissible under certain circumstances.
I don't think that it has.
Well, it should.
Mm-hmm.
It should. And, you know, polygraph and hypnosis both are kind of, you know, polygraph is measuring subconscious reactions that are showing up in physical response.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Hypnosis, you're listening to the subconscious responses So the reaction of the body is that it's speaking and telling what the mind is remembering.
Right.
So to me, that's pretty equivalent, I think. You know, but anyway. Okay, so, you know, your experience is, your experiences are that you were subjected to this abuse and mind control, and both on Earth and off Earth. When you were on the moon, did you see, now we know you saw this reptilian on the craft, that your thought about that is he was probably the pilot. Okay, but once you got to the moon, did you see any other non-humans?
Not that I remember, but there was a sense that they were there, that they had their own basis there.
All right.
There was some interfacing between human beings and between extraterrestrials that were on the moon.
How did you get out of all of this?
How did I get out of it?
Yeah. Well, in other words, how did you make the MILABS stop?
Well, I can talk about the session I had with Mary, because that gave me an insight into that.
Okay. You know what? There's one other question I have about the moon.
Sure.
And then we'll get to that.
Sure.
Were there any other women there?
Very few.
You did see some?
Again, this is kind of difficult because, you know, it was such a difficult experience even just being there, but I would need more hypnosis.
Okay.
To dig into that, my sense is that there were other women there, but I didn't have much, if any, contact with them.
Okay. All right. So now you were about to tell us that your session with Mary Rodwell gave you a clue about how all this came to an end.
Yes.
All right.
Well, I've been a spiritual person my whole life, before I even knew how to describe it as spiritual, you know.
Okay.
And in my later years, I finally got to the point that I admitted that I was having, you know, experience of spirit guides or spiritual guidance. And before I had the session with Mary Rodwell, interestingly enough, I kept getting this vision plopped in my head, and it wouldn't go away, despite me trying to push it away, of a boardroom someplace, possibly in the Pentagon, where somebody, where a full bird colonel or maybe a brigadier general was officiating at a meeting, and somebody tosses a file out in the middle of the table and says, "She's talking, what are we going to do about this?" And this top brass person takes the file, and it's my file, and he sets it aside, and he says, "We're going to leave her completely alone." And this happens every so often with my spirit guides. They'll put some thought or image in my head, and that image will persist until I pay attention to it in a particular way, and then it will go away. So I had this thought come to me all the time, and I thought, okay, what the heck is this? Is this some kind of wishful thinking on my part, you know, and why can't I just make it go away? And this kind of tells me that I'm special, and I don't believe that I'm special, and I just wish it would go away. So then I met Mary Rodwell in person at the 2010 UFO Congress, where I was a speaker, and she did a session with me, and I told her about this vision that just would not go away. It just kept coming into my head. And so we looked at it when I was under hypnosis with her, and I actually contacted in the hypnosis session. It was like I somehow went to visit fifth dimensional ETs out on a very, very advanced ship, and the person who was in charge of that ship took me traveling, let's say, during the hypnosis session. And he, one of the places that he took me, he says, we're going to now go to the moon of the past when you were there. And I said, I don't want to go anywhere near that place. It was horrible there. And he says, you need to see this thing that I'm going to show you, this exchange that happened when you were there that I'm going to show you. And I said, okay. So we went there, and it was like we were there in energetic form. And I saw this exchange happen between a superior officer who was in charge of my time on the moon and an extraterrestrial. And the extraterrestrial had seen me there and was saying to the superior officer, you have no idea who you have there. You realize that everything you're doing to her gets reported back to her people.
Hmm.
And,
So who are your people?
Who are my people?
Yeah,
that's
who
a
are
good
your
question.
People?
As I have peeled away the layers of all this and listened to my inner guidance and followed the synchronicities, This is the way it seems, and nobody has to believe it or take my word for it or anything else like that. I've set it all down to the best of my ability in my book, which is going to be being published in the next 2 to 3 months, just how the whole thing unfolded for me. But as I have peeled away the layers and done the healing work and set aside my fear and had my consciousness expand more and more, the more I set the fear aside, the more it has come, the point seems to be driven home to me that before I came into this life, I was part of this fifth dimensional extraterrestrial group that lives in a ship in far Earth orbit, not near Earth, but far Earth orbit. And they kind of look at humanity as a collective. And they know that bad things are happening here, but they don't really have a grasp of it because they're looking at humanity more as a collective than as a collection of individuals. And they said, well, Niara, you've been kind of involved with humanity in various ways in your life, so how would you feel about taking on a human lifetime and going down and having certain experiences happen to you? And then when you're asleep, your astral form will come back to the ship and we will get the experiences firsthand from you. And I said, sure, I'd do it. I would do it. And so I did. And I came into this lifetime and I came into a family where gray Zeta Reticulan abductions were taking place. And so that was part of my experience. And that part of my experience set up the military experiences later, and so I kind of had a soul contract, so to speak. And this, I know this may be way out there for some of your listeners, others of your listeners will probably resonate with this, but apparently I took on a soul contract to have these experiences and report what it was like for a human woman to have these, go through these experiences and report it back to my people. So this ET, because of his expanded psychic abilities, he could look at me and see in my energy field who I was, and that's why he told the superior officer, you know, you have no idea who you have there. You realize everything you're doing to her gets reported back to the people. And it seemed to me that shortly after that, I got my brain dry cleaned and I got drummed out of that whole experience, and that was the end of it.
Actually, when you first began to recover your memories, it disturbed you so much you didn't talk about it for a while, though, right?
A long time, many years.
Uh huh.
I just didn't want to deal with it. I was afraid to talk, for one thing, and I was kind of like in some kind of limbo where I didn't really want to accept what had happened to me, yet I felt the full force of the post-traumatic stress of it,
mm-hmm.
and I was scared to death. You know, I mean, that's the really telling thing, is if in any way, shape, or form, I thought this wasn't real, I wouldn't have been so scared to talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Have you since Let's go back to the very first event where you were taken at gunpoint from your hotel and taken out to the Tonopah test range.
Yeah.
And other crew members were brought out there as well. And you were trying to track these, well, for lack of a better term, we'll say unidentified flying objects. Extraterrestrial or not, it's something you haven't seen before. Okay, right. So, now, when that happened, you were not allowed to talk with these crew members.
No.
Other than whatever was necessary for the job, no other conversation. Have you, since you've begun talking about all this, have you run into any of these crew members? Have you had the opportunity to meet or talk with any of them?
No, I haven't.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be a pretty touchy thing.
Uh-huh.
Because either they're remembering or they're not remembering. And people have to come to the memory in their own good time. Otherwise, it's... You have to have some, you know, have to be at least a little bit prepared. You know, and discovering 3 months of missing time, that was kind of my preparation because I couldn't, you know, your imagination runs wild when you have 3 months of missing time. It's like, well, what the heck happened, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I needed some answers. You know, I didn't like the ones I got, but, you know, I did finally come to terms with them over a period of years.
You made a statement earlier that, you know, when I ask about these people that were pointing guns at you and I was asking about their uniforms and so forth, and you said that you would hate to think that this is something that regular military would do and that, you know, you thought these were probably contractors.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? This is just my opinion. It really doesn't make a rat's ass difference because you had officers on board that ship that took you to the moon. You had officers who knew what was going on, and if it was contractors that were doing it, these officers still had the authority to put a stop to it.
Yeah, they're still complicit, and this is what makes the whole disclosure scenario of a government disclosure so difficult. Again, I address that in my book as well, is the difficulties around disclosure, because people have died. People have been abused, not just me. You know, I mean, I'm just one of many. Okay, people have been severely abused. And they've had years of post-traumatic stress that's taken a toll on their lives. It's taken a toll on their family lives. In some cases, probably destroyed their family lives.
And probably there have been some who committed suicide as a result.
Yeah, and I was nearly one of those. Before I got the memories back, I was having all this free-floating anxiety. I was having pretty severe heart palpitations. I was having all kinds of things that were going on that I couldn't pin down to a cause. And it caused me almost to take my own life. And then I came right up to the point, almost did it, and then I backed away from it and thought, I don't think this is a good way out. And I made what I call a 500% commitment to healing, no matter what it took, no matter what I had to do.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew I couldn't go on living with that kind of anxiety. And then that's when it seemed like one synchronicity after another led me to the discovery of the missing time and then reclaiming some of the memory and then dealing with it, you know. But it took a lot of time. It took me 14, 15 years after reclaiming the memory and trying to come to terms with it to even come forward and do anything publicly with it. Because I didn't want to. That was the last thing I wanted to do. I mean, this would make you laugh. It makes me laugh. When the memories first came out, I thought, well, God damn it. You know, if I ever start talking about this, the only job opportunity I'm going to have is speaking at UFO conferences. I'll be damned. you know? And so that was kind of how I was about it for a long time. You know, I just didn't want to do that. I just wanted a normal life. But it just wasn't meant to be. Not for me, I guess. All my efforts to try to live a normal life went nowhere. And the most normal life that I've had has been happened to me since I went public. So, go figure.
Well, I'll tell you what I would like to do. You and I are going to continue talking, but what I would like to do is open up the telephone lines and invite our audience to join in the conversation. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Kevin, this is Jerome from Pennsylvania.
Hello, Jerome.
Hi. Hi, Nara, and thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you. I appreciate you listening.
One thing I'd like to point out, you said that the most normal part you had is once you opened up and start sharing your story. Kevin suggested that he ask you if you knew any of the other members that you, back in the 80s, that you were on your team, and you said that you didn't want to get in touch with them. I think it might be a good idea if you could get in touch with them, because they might be going through the same thing that you've been going through, with maybe not as good results.
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly hope that once my book is out there, that I would prefer to wait and let such individuals get in touch with me rather than me seek them out, because I really don't want to intrude on their life or interfere with their life. I know how scared I was when I got my memory back and I had to start dealing with all this. I know how scared it made me. And so I feel like it has to be their individual choice whether they want to reach out and try to contact me or not. But for me to try to seek them out, it just doesn't feel like the right thing to do.
Well, if it doesn't feel right, then don't do it, that's for sure. And I'll leave the air now, Kevin. And once again, I just want to say thank you to Nirara.
Okay. All right. Bye. Thank you. Yeah. It's Niara. You know, that's an unusual name for here in the United States. Do you know, Niara, it's a pretty name, but do you know, does it have a particular origin?
I was born Janet Marie.
Uh-huh.
Janet Marie Isley. And then, you know, because I've been involved in spiritual pursuits, especially after I turned 40, I just decided I just couldn't ignore all the spiritual things that were coming to me in my life. And so I did something. I was born the 11th month, 11th day at 11 a.m.
Uh-huh.
And so there was this spiritual event that was happening centered around 11-11, opening the gateway back in the early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, well, I better do that because I have all these 11s lined up in my birthday. It's a synchronicity. I should follow that. So I did that. And I did a meditation for my star name to be part of that event. And Niara Terela was the name that came. And okay. I liked it right away, and I started using it right away. And then a couple years later, I made it a legal change to that name. It just feels good. It feels right.
Yeah.
And so that's how the name came about.
All right. Let's go back to the telephone.
It does have a meaning, though.
I'm sorry?
It does have a meaning.
Oh, what's the meaning?
About 10 years after I took the name and made it legal, somebody directed me to a website called Niara.org, and I found out that Niara is a West African name that means woman of high purpose.
Oh, well, that's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, to the telephone, and caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Kevin, this is Brent from Wyoming.
Hello, Brent.
Niara, I'm going to describe something to you. Tell me if this sounds familiar.
Mm-hmm.
What I experienced one time, I was walking home from work. I live in a relatively small town, so it's pretty easy. I had inadvertently put myself into a light hypnotic trance. A dog barked and brought me out of that suddenly, and I felt like my body was filled with carbonated water. It'd been shaken up, and all the bubbles were rushing to my head.
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound familiar to what you we experienced when they gave you that shot?
Yes, it does. It sounds very familiar.
I am wondering if they use that to chemically induce a suggestive state to you.
That's possible. Or it's possible that they were testing the drug to see what it would do at the time it was used on me. And
yeah.
Then maybe determined its uses later on.
Yeah, well, that was
but
my
it does sound very it gave me the chills. It sounded so familiar and so similar that it gave me a chill.
Yeah, I understand what you went through.
Yeah.
Okay,
thanks.
That's all I wanted to say. Goodbye.
All right, Brent, thank you.
Bye.
So, caller, your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. Hi, Niara. My name is Victoria, and I'm calling from Washington State.
Hello, Victoria.
And for some reason, I'm just, like, feeling really nervous about asking this question, and I just, I'm getting really jittery, so it's kind of a tough question, I guess. But I was wondering, can you, if you could answer this, do you remember the faces of the people that you met on this at this other location? I mean, you know, funny thing, my computer went, you know, sorry. Right when you said where you went, so I didn't hear where you went on the spaceship, but or whatever the vehicle.
She went to the.
But I was wondering.
She went to the moon.
And then also, do you remember the faces, or do you remember the names of these people that came there? And I have another question too.
I don't remember names. I don't remember. I remember some faces. The blonde security guard I mentioned, I could probably work with a forensic artist and get a rendering of him, and possibly the other security guard that did the other sexual assault.
What about the officers?
The officers, the memory is a whole lot less clear with them, but I do have a feeling that if I saw them, that I would remember them.
Okay. Okay, Victoria, you had another question?
Yes, I do. I was wondering if the people that came to visit, the visitors, you know, that just came from off planet or to this location, and you didn't say where it was, but...
yeah, she did. It's the moon.
They were abusive also.
No, she did say, it's the moon.
Oh, I didn't hear that. I just...
Yeah.
My computer shut down and I didn't hear it.
Okay, so your question is, were they abusive also?
The people that came to visit, yes.
I don't think that it was military per se that were doing the abuse on the moon. I think it was more contract personnel. I didn't see uniforms or anything like that in that instance.
Yeah, I think she was talking about the extraterrestrials that were there. Did they?
No. You said that people came to visit to observe from Earth, and
yeah.
I was just wondering if they participated in this also, or did they just watch?
I don't think that they participated or watched. I think that that it was just part of my role as being used for whatever labor that they wanted to be used. You know, they wanted to use me. And, you know, one thing that people need to understand is this is not any girl's dream to have these kind of experiences and then talk about them on stage or on radio shows or anything else like that. It's a difficult thing to even be on and talk about this, even after all the times I've already done it. It's still not easy.
Yeah.
But it is necessary. It's necessary that people know this is going on. I wouldn't be here talking to you about it and reporting it as true events if I hadn't spent years researching and talking to other people and digging up other testimony that corroborates mine. You know, I wouldn't even be here doing this if I didn't feel very solid about the fact that this really did happen. And it's not just me that it's happened to. You know, it's like years of research, years of testimony, years of understanding all the political and social context in which these kinds of experiences can even happen to a person on this on Earth. That corroborates my own testimony. That would even permit me in my own integrity to be on this radio show talking to you about this. You know, if I had not done all those years of study and research and questing and trying to dig up information that fit with my own, but there's so much information out there that intersects with my own, that was what finally got me to the point where I felt like I had to go public, I had to talk about it for my own healing. Because if you're not talking about it because you're terrified or you're scared, then that still has a hold over you. You're not healing in that in any way, shape, or form if you're afraid to talk. So being out here talking and doing these shows is a necessary part of my healing. It means that I'm throwing off the fear, at least to the degree that I can be out here talking to you.
And when you and I talked earlier, you know, we talked about how important it is for anybody that's been through anything like this to talk about it and to, you know, they have to begin to talk about it in order to face the fear and, as you say, throw off the fear. Have you talked about this with your Earth family?
Yeah, it took a long time for me to talk about it with my Earth family, but I did, and, you know, finally told them not only about my experiences, but all the corroborating testimony that I've collected over the years. And
how did they take it?
Well, my mother didn't want to believe it, but when you present people with all the corroborating information, it's very hard to stay in denial about it. So I don't know that she still believes in what I have to say 100%, but she also knows that I'm a person of integrity. So that, I guess that's good enough for her, and also for my brother. My father is no longer living. But for the most part, my immediate family is good with it. My kids are good with it. I have grown children, and they're supportive.
Well, anyone who thinks that this sort of stuff just couldn't happen needs to go back and research what was called the Church Committee. It was not the Church Committee because it was religious. It's because the senator's name was Frank Church. And they delved into all kinds of things that were deep and dark and nasty that were going on in our government, including the Montauk Project. And that Montauk Project included a whole lot of this kind of stuff. It's a matter of congressional record. It's a matter of Senate investigation record. And, ladies and gentlemen, it's not a joke. It's not a myth. It's not a rumor. It's not a conspiracy theory. These things actually happened. These types of things actually were going on, actually happened, and are part of the official record of Senate investigations. So now we're almost out of time. In fact, we got less than a minute. Let me ask you very quickly this, Niara. Do you think it's still going on?
Yes, I do think it's still going on, though I'm guessing it's probably going on less. Because disclosure is a movement of the people, and it is moving forward. And these people, you know, one of the problems with disclosure is all these things that have been done that are going to come out, and people are going to want blood. I'm not one of them. I'm more like, you know, let's just have disclosure and let's have free energy and change the face of this planet for the better. And then we'll work out what consequences these people deserve.
Okay, I wish we had more time, but we don't. I am 8 seconds from the end. Ladies and gentlemen, I told you don't miss this show, and you're here. You heard it, and now you know why.